Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Nikki Ouellette. A summer camp lives out Wyoming's vision for attracting young people to the state's outdoor industry, even if camp chores include moving 90-pound hay bales.
So it's kind of up to you guys how you want to come up with a strategy.
We hear from Cherokee painter D.G. House about how the greater Yellowstone ecosystem inspires her art.
Art is for everyone. You don't have to understand it. You don't have to have a budget for it. You're entitled to it.
Furry friends on reservations are feeling the heat from climate change.
It's getting to the point where if creeks and places are drying up like any other animal, they're having a hard time finding resources.
And highlights of a bike race from Logan, Utah to Jackson Hole. Lotuja. Get it? Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces. Stay with us.
Sometimes the news can be a little hard, but Around Wyoming is here to bring you the lighter side of things. Ever heard of frozen chicken curling? Or do you know how many of our residents compete in and win national competitions? Hint, it's a lot. Around Wyoming brings you that and more four times every weekday. You can also find Around Wyoming on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Nikki Ouellette. Many emergency medical service agencies in Wyoming are struggling financially. Most have found ways to make ends meet despite rising costs and more complex expectations. But communities may have some difficult conversations ahead about how to pay for what many consider a necessary service. Madeline Beck, who's a health and safety reporter for WyoFile, just published a three-part series looking into the state of EMS agencies in Wyoming. I spoke with her recently about her findings. Right now, is there anywhere in Wyoming where if I were to call 911 because I had a medical emergency that nobody would respond?
Hard to say. Right now, there are so many areas that are so far out there. I'm not aware of any pocket of the state where just nobody would respond ever. But what we're seeing is increasingly strapped EMS agencies, so it's becoming increasingly hard to respond to certain areas. So there are plenty of locations where it would be expected that an ambulance on the road would take 20, 30, 40 minutes to get out to these rural locations. The vast majority of the state is outside of the 30-minute response time.
Oh, wow. And that's a time when every minute counts. And, you know, taking that ambulance ride typically comes with a pretty hefty bill. But at the same time, these ambulance services are struggling financially. Can you kind of break down that math?
So the problems come from multiple different directions. We're seeing ambulance costs go up, gas costs go up, costs of living going up. Trying to pay someone who's an EMT in Cody, it's going to start costing more. And then you have health insurance costs going up. And then you have medical supply costs going up. All of these costs going up. Well, at the same time, you see major payers like Medicare and Medicaid, their reimbursement rates have largely stagnated. And that is for, of course, the patients who have didn't even have insurance. The problem is in rural Wyoming, there's simply not enough people who have reimbursable rides or reimburse enough money for those rides to pay for your 24/7 crew, for your ambulance.
One of the stats in your story, it would take 600 trips a year to break even for an ambulance with basic life support.
Yeah, more than 600. So it's about 650 for a basic life support ambulance. So we're not talking about the advanced life support ambulance that you might need for that older patient who has critical care issues. So you have all these different challenges. And at the same time, you have a decreasing volunteerism. If you have fewer volunteers, obviously you're going to have to hire people if you want a 24/7 crew to respond when you call 911. So it's complicated math. And I should say EMS agencies run out of a variety of systems. So they run out of hospitals. Some of them are private. Some of them are funded by local government or partially funded by local government. I mean, the way EMS has formed across the country, it's a relatively new idea. We're talking late 60s, early 70s when we started to see any sort of formalization of these systems. We really only started funding them as a transport service to a hospital.
An expensive taxi.
Yeah, it's a hospital Uber. The initial idea was these should be self-sustaining, but we as a society have collectively asked them to step up what they are able to do for us. And by doing so, we have saved more lives. Major incidents have become more survivable. That said, funding for them has not stepped up.
You looked at a bunch of different ways that we could address this. One way is for the state to declare EMS an essential service. Lawmakers considered this back in 2023, but they nixed the idea. What would that designation mean?
So this is the idea that we should tell counties or towns that they have to provide EMS. The challenge there is a lot of people see it as a potential unfunded mandate. So if I come in and say, hey, Albany County, hey, Laramie County, you now have to provide this level of EMS service. If they hadn't been putting in that money before, now that money comes out of something else. And so what ends up getting cut to make room for EMS? And a lot of people say, you know what? It's necessary. EMS is life-saving.
Yeah, I think that there's like a real expectation that this is a service that will be available to you if you call.
Right. And I think a lot of people still expect that, even if it's becoming increasingly challenging to provide that. AARP just recently released a survey of adults around Wyoming, and two-thirds reported that they are not very or not at all concerned about their ability to access emergency medical services. So it's how do you convince people to even want to support it more if they don't think there's a problem?
One of the other strategies is consolidation. That's something that towns in Eastern Carbon County have been trying out since 2009.
So regionalization is another sticky topic because, one, you can have consolidated billing, right? You can bill out of one office and have one person doing that for an entire area. You can have some economy of scale there. The concern then comes if, for example, up in Star Valley, there are communities that benefit from their regional EMS now that's consolidated, that not all communities that they serve pay into it an equal amount. And so then you have, okay, I've taken up a larger area. Now more areas may or may not pay. And then you have a larger area that if that now larger EMS agency fails, that's more communities at risk. So consolidation has worked for a lot of communities and has a lot of benefits if it can be worked out given certain community dynamics. But there's challenges with it too.
The governor's office has suggested a different tack, community EMS. It's basically allowing home visits from an EMS agency that would be reimbursed similarly to how an ambulance ride is.
So the challenge with a lot of it is that you may be able to convince some insurances to pay for this, but when you look at like federal reimbursement levels from federal insurances, they often are not reimbursing for that service. If I just go to your home because you fell and were scared and had a panic attack, and I'm in an ambulance and I respond and we sit with you and make sure you're okay and you are able to get back down and feel better and you don't need to go to the hospital, all of that time that I spent with you, the miles that I put on the ambulance, that is all unreimbursable. So I think you see the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services looking at that as a potential solution, but some of their trial runs have been unsuccessful. It hasn't raised enough money.
What surprised you or stuck with you the most from reporting this series?
I think what stuck with me the most has been how precarious of a situation we currently find ourselves in. I think it's hard to know when you only call 911 for an emergency that system is struggling. How would you know? You just expect them to get there as quick as possible. So I think seeing the challenges that are so widespread, and there are so many of them that are impacting EMS, and how few people understand the challenges they're facing, I think those are the things that stand out for me.
That was Madeline Beck, health and public safety reporter for WyoFile, talking about her recent series called A Critical Call about EMS agencies in Wyoming. One way Beck says the public can help, learn CPR, and stock public spaces with AED machines. Or, if you're able, consider volunteering for your local EMS agency. Now, let's talk about Reservation Dogs. And no, I don't mean the Emmy-nominated show on Hulu. We're talking about the furry friends who often roam freely on Native American reservations. Since the COVID-19 pandemic, animal shelters have been at capacity nationwide, but especially on reservations that have underfunded infrastructure. And now climate change is adding another layer of problems. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Merzbach sat down with Taylor Stagner to talk about how res dogs are being affected by extreme wildfires and heat waves. Stagner might be a familiar name for longtime Open Spaces listeners, as she used to report for us. She's based in Riverton and now writes about tribal affairs for Grist, a climate-focused publication.
Taylor, thanks so much for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Hannah.
So you recently wrote a story for Grist titled, Res Dogs Are Feeling the Heat from Climate Change. Your story focuses on the San Carlos Apache Reservation down in southeast Arizona. Tell me what you were hearing from people there. What did this issue look like?
The issue seemed, well, particularly dire because they had just gone through this horrible fire earlier in the summer. It was called the Watch Fire. It devastated the community. It destroyed 20 homes, about 2,000 acres. And the person that I found, her name was Julie Cazador, and she's Apache, and she was running around trying to save all these dogs.
I've been rescuing for now 13 years, actively for like 7 years.
The dogs had burnt paws, and so she was like out there rescuing them, and she was out there doing that, she said, until midnight or so. And they don't have a shelter, so they had to like makeshift a shelter, which is really rough to do, especially when, you know, the world's on fire and you're trying to find a safe place to put these animals. And also people are having a hard time finding places to be.
The animals are like forgotten. So if we weren't here as a rescue group, these people would have nobody to help them with their animals. So we fundraise for the funding for the pets that were burnt.
They recently got approval from their tribal council to build a shelter there. So that's in the works right now. So they'll be more prepared in the future for the increasing wildfires that we're seeing here in the West.
That's great to hear. So yeah, this was an incident where there was a wildfire, but with extreme heat, dogs get hot, just like humans. Were you seeing these climate change impacts across reservations across the West?
So it's definitely not all reservations, but there was a few, and there was enough in my reporting to see that there was a problem, because while reservation dogs are beloved by their community, and what I heard from many caregivers is that they're quite adaptable. They're very spunky, I guess. They can really adapt to many different shifts in climate, because they do exist in these more harsh situations than, you know, a dog that, you know, stays inside, which makes sense. But a lot of these caregivers were saying that, well, it's getting to the point where if creeks and places are drying up like any other animal, they're having a hard time finding resources.
Right. And of course, you know, the fire you were mentioning down in the San Carlos Reservation, that also came after the pandemic. I mean, how did this kind of make the problem worse?
Yeah, and we see this on the Wind River Reservation. I mean, a lot of clinics were happening to spay and neuter pets. It's a great way to curb the animal population, just spay and neuter your pets. But during the pandemic, a lot of reservations shut down. You can't come and perform these surgeries. So what happened then was not all, but many places kind of, you know, had an influx. And this is not a problem specifically for reservations only. Like, I want to be clear about that. It's a problem a lot of places. And I think it shows up on reservations in a particular way that I find very interesting, because reservation dogs end up being kind of part of the landscape. It's a complicated situation, but I mean, they're almost wildlife. I mean, it's kind of interesting to think of them that way. But to manage them is kind of difficult. But shelters everywhere are experiencing just an influx in animals, and they're just having a hard time placing them. And some of them end up just roaming around and, you know, maybe without water is what I was hearing a lot of.
Yeah. Will you walk me through the numbers on this? Like, do you have a sense of the scale of this issue throughout the region? It seemed like it was hard to get some of those numbers.
It was. I called probably, not everybody would talk to me, but I called 20 shelters in different parts of the country. And there really isn't one hub of like how many dogs that are in foster care and shelters. The American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals gave me some recent numbers. So in shelters across the country, there's about 6.5 million dogs and cats entering shelters, but only about 4.8 million get adopted. That gives you kind of a countrywide scale of like what's going on. But as far as like how many locally, like those regional numbers are really hard. I mean, a lot of places are at capacity. Going back to Julie on the San Carlos Reservation, I mean, it was her and a group of Apache volunteers.
I'm doing it because no one's helping their animals, not with dog food, not with cat food. So someone has to do it, and no one wants to do it. So I took on the task with other volunteers.
And they are still, you know, building that capacity. It's just really difficult when you're looking at the scale of the problem. But that's one thing that I think is really important. There is such a pretty much everywhere I called, people were very excited about this work and very like dedicated to it, which was very heartening. It was very like, wow, this is being addressed despite lack of resources. Hopefully people understand like how climate change is going to make the problem worse, not better, especially with these wildfires, extreme weather. It's going to make some of our most vulnerable people, but also animals. It's going to make it worse for everyone.
That was Taylor Stagner, who reports on tribal affairs for the climate-focused outlet, Grist. You can check out her story, titled Res Dogs Are Feeling the Heat from Climate Change, at grist.org. Coming up, a summer camp trains Wyoming's future outdoor leaders. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Wyoming Public Media is providing Wyoming and Western wildfire updates on air and now online. Go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on Wyoming Wildfire Info. You'll find links to the latest updates on fires around the region, along with information on current air quality conditions, fire restrictions, information on protecting your property, and more. Find it all in one place at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Summer is wrapping up, so we thought we'd take a look back at a part of many of our childhoods, summer camp. But this one is a little different. It's a partnership between a ranch in Bondurant, a wildlife nonprofit, and the state of Wyoming for kids across the country who wouldn't otherwise have these kinds of outdoor opportunities. It attempts to live out the state's vision for teaching youth about the outdoors. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan takes us there.
It's midsummer at the base of Bondurant's Grovant Mountains, and 17 boys are living their best lives. 13-year-old Colton Christensen of Kinnear, Wyoming, has mud on his cheeks. He takes a break from helping restore a beaver pond to explain a typical morning.
So we wake up, some of us get hot chocolate.
Is it early?
Yeah, like usually 6. Like,
you can also go to like the sluice box.
Yeah, like the sluice box.
Sluice boxes were used over 150 years ago to separate gold from water. But here today, they funnel ice-cold stream water off a hillside. 12-year-old Zach Cortez of Riverton explains it's a shower.
I do it in the morning to get waked up. It's way better than coffee.
And you guys are drinking coffee?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Because somebody decided to drink all the hot cocoa.
Yeah, it's worth the coffee now.
The week-long camp is spent fully outside, working, playing, and learning about future outdoor careers. Chris McBarnes runs the Wyoming Wildlife Fund, which is the nonprofit arm for the Game and Fish. And he's helped with the camp since its first summer in 2022.
The hook are the mountains and the fly fishing and the horseback riding. That's what gets the kids here.
And once they're hooked, McBarnes hopes that the excitement reels some of these kids back one day.
If we don't do this, we won't have the future conservationists and leaders that will continue to make Wyoming all it is today.
It's out of a Wyoming Game and Fish and Governor Mark Gordon initiative called Inspire a Kid, and a partnership with the Little Jenny Ranch in Bondurant. And McBarnes says even just in a few years, the influence is tangible. He recently heard from a camper from last summer.
This young man has completely changed his career goals. He wants to be a conservation officer. That is his dream. That is his passion now.
McBarnes sees this kid's experience as proof of concept for the camp, and he'd like to see it replicated across the state. It's part of a multi-pronged effort to attract and keep more young people in Wyoming, which has seen the majority of people born in the state leave by their 30s. It's a lofty goal for a little camp, but McBarnes and instructor Chris Story say starting down a career path begins with learning basic skills, like how to feed the camp's horses.
There's enough hay on this truck that we need to unload and stack that everybody is responsible for one bale.
Green square hay bales tower over the kiddos on the truck. One bale probably weighs more than each boy. And Story points to an area about 40 feet away that they need to move the hay to.
So it's kind of up to you guys how you want to come up with a strategy.
Story throws a few bales off the truck for the kids to start on.
It's going
to
bounce, guys, so you got to stay back. There's one.
The boys partner in pairs of two and each take an end of a bale, doing kind of an awkward shuffle and breathing heavily.
No, we need to put it back there.
And sure, not all these kids need to know how to move hay bales in the future. But it's more than that. It's problem solving, teamwork, leadership, physical movement, a sense of accomplishment, and of course, a love of Wyoming's outdoors.
Yeah, I think I've kind of fallen in love with the mountains here. So that's the biggest thing, is that I want to try to come back here.
15-year-old William Johnston came all the way from New Jersey. He lives in a city, and this is the first time he's been in the mountains. And his other takeaway? Bring layers.
Sleeping is pretty cold.
Because in Wyoming, even during summer camp, winter is always coming. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan in Bondurant.
A large blue bear, purple moose, brightly colored geometric shapes. This is the way D.G. House sees the animals and landscapes of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem and how she brings them to life in her paintings. An enrolled member of the Cherokee Tribe of Northeast Alabama, she's been part of the Indigenous Arts and Cultural Demonstration Residency Program at Grand Teton National Park for decades.
Your job is to interact with the visitors, help them with whatever they want to know, including where's the ice cream. It's your job to know all of that. And then you talk about art.
House told Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman the stories behind a few of her paintings at the Coulter Bay Visitor Center, where the artist spent the week practicing her craft in real time.
Many, many years ago, I was at Old Faithful, and a man walks by. He never stops. He just says this to me as he goes by. You should only paint in the colors that appear in this park. And I watched him walk off. And I thought, yes. So I changed at that moment. My entire palette now, every color on it, appears in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. But what I do that's different is I will use the colors in a different subject, meaning that I do a blue that appears in so many of the beautiful springs in Yellowstone, but they now become blue bears. Or the purple of the mountains become purple moose. Behind Jackson Lake Lodge decades ago, I was down there, went down the steps behind the lodge and in the willows, a bull moose came out in the full moon and he glowed purple. So my moose have been mostly purple ever since then. And that's how these real experiences happen. My art is also based on a real experience. So every single painting you see from me, something happened for real. This bison in particular, it was just like, I would say 3 years ago, and I'm coming from lake to canyon, and he was a raggedy boy. And he was so powerful and so big, and the grass was so, when you see grass that's that yellow green, and he was walking on the side of the road. We were all alone. Nobody else ever came, our whole interaction. And I literally was able to just pull over and watch him walk out the window. I mean, it happens to a lot of people, but that was a moment for me. This was all about light and being alone. It gets rarer and rarer to have an interaction with wildlife that it's just yours. Yours and theirs. And this was one of those moments. Let me tell you one. I hope you're all interested in this one. I'm coming off of the old road before the flood, out of Mammoth, and I'm going down to Gardner, and there's a pull-off right there by Mount Everett. I pull off, there are two wolves in the creek, and they're pulling something, and I look, and it's an elk leg. And they're literally tussling, whatever you want to call it, and tossing it and all that. So I step out of the car. You have to understand, I'm so far away. And I'm leaning on my car. I'm not walking anywhere. I pull up the lens, and they stop. And they look at me, and every cell in my body said, "Get in the car." And I immediately got in the car and rolled up the window and enjoyed them doing what they did. But I'll tell you, every instinct in my body, I knew. It didn't matter that I was that far away. I knew what they said. It's like, you got it. You are in charge. I am visiting your house. So I got in the car. Anyway, there's a painting of that too, of the two of them with the elk leg going back and forth. And I made that stare. Both of them looking at the out of the canvas, and it was the same look. Make the time to visit state park, your national park. Don't say someday. Don't say someday. Just say I'm going and pick a date and go.
That was artist D.G. House describing her paintings during her week-long residency with the Indigenous Arts and Cultural Demonstration Program at Grand Teton National Park. The program is shifting to focus on artists from tribes with traditional ties to the area. House is now a legacy artist, or as she calls it, the old lady of the residency. She says she'll come back for as long as they'll have her. This story was produced by Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman. Up next, as Lake Powell shrinks, native plants are making a comeback. We'll tag along to count them. This is Open Spaces.
This time on The Modern West, we trace back the beginnings of the cowboy to the Mexican vaquero.
Well, this was Mexico, so the United States came to us. We didn't go to them.
Se benefician de ella. It's part two of our series, The Great Individualist. Find The Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org. While you're there, we'd love it if you'd consider supporting our podcasts. Just click on the red donate button.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Nikki Ouellette. Water levels in Lake Powell have been at or near record lows as the Colorado River is strained by climate change and steady demand. But as the nation's second largest reservoir recedes, it's making way for thriving ecosystems. Alex Hager with KUNC in Northern Colorado tagged along with a team of scientists trying to figure out what's coming back.
When you see a research paper, you see data and conclusions. What you don't see is this, the messy process of science in action.
I guess as an ecologist, I can't quite bring myself to just hack down vegetation.
Seth Arns is gently pushing his way through towering, dense grasses, charting a path to his research site along the muddy canyon floor.
Oh, quicksand, quicksand.
What's the best way around?
You can go through it, but just quickly.
Arnes is a research scientist with Western Water Assessment. After about a mile of arduous trekking, he starts to look for a foot-long piece of rebar that marks the spot where he'll start counting plants.
I need to use the pictures, my notes, and wandering around and a little bit of luck to find those.
I feel like using plants as a reference point here is a dicey game.
It is a dicey game, but sometimes there's not much else. There's not other choices.
So we are looking for a gray stick in a field of gray sticks.
You got it.
This process is not made any easier by the kind of desert heat that leaves you dizzy. It's in the triple digits as the southern Utah sun bakes the red rock of this narrow canyon. But eventually...
This is it. I found it.
Oh my gosh.
No way.
There
we go. Wow.
Hey, you win.
Oh, that's very exciting.
And now the counting can begin.
Bromus tectorum, 1 liter 4.
Arnes and his research assistant, Katie Woodward, are producing the first ever serious data on what plants are living here in an area that is seeing the light of day after spending decades submerged under Lake Powell.
Nature has given us a second chance to reevaluate how we're going to manage this place.
So far, Arnes is finding mostly native plants, the same kind that were last here in the 1970s, before the area was flooded for the reservoir.
And now not only is it not under the lake, but it turns out nature is doing a pretty good job by itself of coming back and establishing thriving ecosystems.
But the federal government says the opposite, that this area is dominated by invasive species, and if they manage the reservoir in such a way that water levels go back up, the only plants that will get drowned will be the bad kind. Eric Balkin says that is demonstrably false.
When I read that, I just thought, had these people even been to Glen Canyon? I mean, this place is a vibrant, you know, burgeoning ecosystem.
Balkin runs the Glen Canyon Institute, a nonprofit that advocates for draining Lake Powell and storing that water elsewhere, in part to help restore the things that used to live here before. The Bureau of Reclamation, so inaccurately describing what lives here, he says, is not a good place to start.
It's almost laughable. And that's got to change.
Reclamation declined to be interviewed for this story, but wrote in an email that it was mostly considering the plants downstream of Lake Powell, not these ones, and that its water release plans, quote, have negligible effects on lake levels and vegetation. After a long day of counting plants, Katie Woodward, the research assistant, is watching dusk fall over a patch of native willows where the canyon stream meets Lake Powell. She says getting this right now, is pivotal.
There's an incredible moment for species that are feeling the pressures of both human-induced and naturally driven change to have a chance for survival in a future that feels really unknown and kind of scary when you think about what's happening to our planet's biodiversity.
Some of those unknowns might get settled soon. The next rules for managing Lake Powell and the Colorado River are due in 2026. In Glen Canyon, I'm Alex Hager.
The shortgrass prairie of northeast Colorado's Pawnee National Grassland is home to a unique and fragile ecosystem. But development is starting to spill onto the plains, threatening one of the country's largest untouched expanses of prairie habitat. KUNC's Ray Solomon reports for the Mountain West News Bureau.
Emma Balanik has been snapping pictures of a pile of rocks since 2019 for a graduate project in conservation photography.
This is the wireless sensor that I point towards the rock pile. So whenever something is there, the camera will take a picture.
The rock pile sits atop a hill covered in patchy cactus and stubby tufts of grass. It's just inside the western edge of the Pawnee grassland, which from this vantage point appears endless.
It's one of the highest points, so you have a 360-degree view of the prairie. So to the west, you have the mountains. to the north, there's these beautiful buttes along the Cheyenne Ridge.
Belenik is a grad student studying wildlife at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. She says the rock pile is a beacon, a prairie crossroads attracting an astonishing array of wildlife. Golden eagles, pronghorn, swift fox, and Belenik's favorite, pairs of coyotes and badgers who team up to prey on nearby colonies of prairie dogs.
The species interactions that I see up here are, from a wildlife standpoint, what I like most about this rock pile.
But Belenik says all those animals and the entire surrounding ecosystem are starting to be threatened by encroaching development. Since 2021, she's watched 3 houses go up within a stone's throw of the rock pile.
The Front Range is expanding into the Eastern Plains for sure.
The Pawnee grassland is more than 190,000 acres of wild prairie managed by the U.S. Forest Service and protected from development. But the public lands lack continuity. The landscape is dotted with privately owned tracts, which are now starting to be subdivided and developed, fragmenting wildlife habitat. According to Forest Service research ecologist Bryce Hanberry, even intermittent roads, fences, and structures disrupt animals' access to water, hunting grounds, and migratory pathways.
What happens ultimately is survival, growth, and reproduction are reduced.
Hanberry says most animals give wide berth to developed land. So in terms of habitat impact, the footprint of each house extends well beyond the property line. And as one house becomes a neighborhood, becomes a whole subdivision.
All of it is cumulatively a big problem for wildlife. It is essentially removal of their natural ecosystems and wildlands and all kinds of interactions and cascades that we may not even know about.
But developing the prairie might prove irresistible to would-be homeowners priced out of the Front Range. Take Kimber Wheeler, who bought one of the parcels near the rock pile with her husband in June of 2020.
With COVID and the finances and the budget, this is the property that we ended up with. And it has become our little slice of heaven we didn't know we were looking for.
Back then, fragile ecosystems were the last thing on their minds, and they wasted no time putting in a fence, outbuildings, and a paved driveway. But learning about the prairie wildlife outside their back door changed their perspective. As a storm rolls in over the plains, Wheeler says it transformed them from opportunistic buyers into full-fledged conservationists.
I feel a little bit guilty because I'm part of the division of that. I see the destruction of something very, very special.
But more and more of the landscape seems destined for development. Just behind the Wheeler's place, another 130 privately owned acres have already been subdivided and put on the market. To grad student Emma Balanik's dismay, they cut even closer to her precious rock pile.
That's all up for sale. And you can see there's stream bed that runs through it, and that's a really important movement corridor for pronghorn, coyotes, badgers, the animals that need a larger expanse of habitat to survive.
Belenik is hoping a conservation buyer will purchase this piece of land, someone who appreciates the prairie ecosystem enough to protect it from future development. Ray Solomon, KUNC.
Next, we'll catch up with cyclists taking a bike ride from Logan, Utah to Jackson Hole in a single day. Can they make it? Stay with us to find out on Open Spaces.
Wyoming Public Radio brings the news to you in our daily and weekly email newsletters. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Over 200 miles, up and down 3 mountain passes, all in a day, on a bike. That's the goal for cyclists from around the world who compete in the annual race from Logan, Utah to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, aptly named Lodija. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Fulpula-Ankeny waded through sweat-soaked skin suits earlier this month to talk to competitors from Jackson as they cross the finish line.
It's a little past 2 p.m., the hottest part of a sweltering September afternoon, and the first riders of the day are approaching the finish line after about 9 hours in the saddle.
All righty, we got some riders coming in.
Cheering onlookers line the metal barriers on Moose Wilson Road in front of Teton Village, some holding signs, including one that reads, "Ride fast, don't die."
Like
an announcer stokes the fanfare through blaring speakers.
Who's gonna do it? There you go, guys. Hey, welcome to Jackson, guys. Nice to have you here.
Riders are competing in 28 different categories, from individuals to team relays to even tandem bikes. They will continue to arrive into the evening. Most finish after 10 to 12 hours. Now in its fourth decade, Lodija includes over 10,000 feet in elevation gain. Think 8 Empire State Buildings stacked on top of one another. Of the roughly 2,000 riders who compete, about a quarter on average don't ever finish. Jackson mechanic Gabe McNeese was one of those riders his first time competing. But this year, he crosses the finish line and gathers among his fellow competitors at the aid station.
My feet hurt really bad.
He and others say the race is hard. It's exhausting. They end up burning an estimated 15,000 calories throughout the day, about five times the recommended daily calorie intake for an average adult.
You're going to go into a dark place, like a really dark place.
So why do it?
I'm not sure. The weird thing about riding a bike is, I don't know, I think it's kind of like any activity that you do, is you just want to do stuff that's hard on it or whatever, and it's accomplishment. I don't know.
Steps away, Ryan Stanley, the president and CEO of Snow King, wanders along the shaded edge of a creek where some bikers are hopping in, cooling off. Stanley trains all year for the race, and he's happy about his performance. It marks a decade of competing, but he's not sure what keeps him coming back.
It's kind of a strange addiction. I don't know. Suffering, I guess.
David Byrne is one of the founders of the race and works to put it on annually to this day. He says the race has grown tremendously since it was the loose idea of his and a friend over 40 years ago while in college at Utah State. That first race had less than a dozen riders, including Byrne.
I remember being absolutely awestruck by the Teton Range and the Grand Teton, and that stuck with me.
Today, the Tetons still leave people awestruck, but it takes over 600 volunteers to work the race, and they've raised over $3 million for the Huntsman Cancer Institute. But it's the racers, he says, that tell him how special the race has become.
They cross the finish line, and they say that that experience changed their life. It made them realize that they can do so much more than they ever thought before. And that's the stuff that gives me goosebumps.
Back at the finish line, Jacksonites Anna Catino, a physician in town, and Ermi Catino, who works in the ski industry, are celebrating their first place finish. It's their third time competing, but first time winning the mixed two-person relay division, meaning they've shared the over 200-mile bike ride throughout the day. They switch from car to bike, bike to car, leapfrogging back to Jackson. Anna says it's a lot of driving.
Which is a little brutal after you bike your brains out.
Ermi says the last leg of the race is special.
It feels kind of nice to bike home. There's some feeling like knowing, like, oh, there's Hoback. Oh, there's the snake. There's the village, like, there's, you know, I don't know, if that's kind of nice.
It's pretty sweet. We feel pretty fortunate for that.
Until next year, Dante Fabula-Inkney, KHOL News.
Now for an even longer ride. Heidi Across America is a new book published by Health Communications. It tells the story of one woman's journey on a bicycle through the heartland in 2010 as she explores self-discovery and slow travel. Wyoming Public Radio's Grady Kirkpatrick spoke with the author, Heidi Byerly.
Welcome, Heidi.
So wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me, Grady.
Yeah, you are originally from Wyoming, now in Washington State. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What inspired you to make this extraordinary coast-to-coast trek from Oregon to Washington, D.C.?
Well, I was having a hard time in life around the time of the 2008 recession, and I was looking at these jobs that sounded very appealing to me, like active transportation planner, and they required a degree that I did not have to be qualified. And while the economy was kind of in the toilet, I thought, well, maybe what I need to kind of get unstuck is to go back to school and get this relevant degree so I can do this work that feels meaningful and purposeful in my life. So I went back to school in 2009, and it was really disruptive to just my personal life. I was like, wow, this is the wrong decision. This is making me feel worse, not better. And all I really wanted to do was ride my bike. That seemed like the thing that would just feel very nourishing to me. And while I was kind of in this downward spiral at the end of my first term, my mom sent me an email, and it was about this Preserving Historic Road conference in Washington, D.C. And I have an uncle out there, and her email was pretty simple. It was like, hey, let's go to this conference and hang out with your uncle. And even though the conference sounded interesting to me, the idea of just like going to a conference and hanging out with family did not sound like the thing that would really excite me about, I don't know, where I was in life. But I was looking at the dates and I was like, oh, it's in middle of September. Like I could actually go there before school started again in the next year. And so I just wrote this kind of flip email back and I was like, sure, I'll pedal out there and meet you. And as soon as I sent the email, I thought, now that is a great idea. I love that. So that was the genesis of the idea. I'd never had any ambitions to ride across the country before that, but suddenly I was like, here I'm going. I'm just going to pedal there.
Once that was decided, I guess the next big decision was the route. How did you decide upon the route to travel?
Well, because I was pretty busy with school in the months leading up to departing on this trip, I tapped into Adventure Cycling Association's resources. And they're an organization that has a number of long distance cross-country cycling routes. And the particular route I chose was really basically it went through Eugene, where I was living in Oregon, and it ended in Yorktown, Virginia, which was kind of close to Washington, D.C. And the nice thing about the Adventure Cycling Association maps is they have the things that cyclists need coded on the map. So I didn't have to do any logistics. Like they figured out the route in terms of like it's a low traffic road or it's maybe a busier road, but it has a wide shoulder. So I didn't have to worry over the details. I just kind of took the ready-made map and went for it.
Part of your research on the trip was exploring small towns and the economic benefits of travelers and bicyclists to towns across America. What were some of the things you discovered?
I certainly discovered that, you know, the towns were spaced very nicely across the country, I thought, for a bicycle traveler. And I made a point to stop and buy things in these little towns.
Which is what most of the cyclists are doing.
Right. And part of what I discovered, too, from talking to other cyclists who were traveling is that, you know, not all bicycle travelers are cut from the same cloth. Some people were out camping and cooking on their own so that, you know, they were stopping in grocery stores more than restaurants. But then there were this other group of cyclists who were like, they didn't want to bother with that. So they were eating at these small town restaurants and staying in the little motels, and they were really more interested in a comfortable experience. And so part of what I was understanding, at least for the rural communities, that if they had a motel or lodging establishment, that was usually the largest investment that a bicycle traveler would have and over the course of a day. And so if a community had a lodging establishment, they would receive more economic benefit from bike travelers coming through. Likewise, if there was actually a bike route through their community, that would actually help attract cyclists to the offerings that they had there. So an adventure cycling route could be one of those things, but in Oregon, we were developing the scenic bikeways and other places. I think of like Bentonville, Arkansas, where they really have a mecca of mountain biking or other things like that, really support the power of people who ride bikes investing in the communities.
Mm-hmm. There's a stretch of highway in Wyoming, 789, that many have traveled from Sweetwater Station to Jeffries City to Muddy Gap onto Rawlins. People have traveled with various modes of transportation over the years, from horses to wagon trains, on foot with hand carts, cars, motorcycles, and of course, bicycles. Was that particular stretch among the most challenging for you?
It was certainly one of more challenging places I went through, but it was also, I think, the most magical or spiritual. You know, being out on a bike, you're really exposed to the elements and the atmosphere and, you know, for lack of a better word, the aura of a place. And when I was pedaling out there, I just felt like the bounds of time had dissolved, and I could sort of experience those feelings of the many different, you listed all these different kinds of ways people have traveled through there, right? It's the Pony Express route and the Oregon Trail, and, you know, Native peoples traveled through there because of South Pass. And I've lost this sense of time about when I was existing in space. And I felt like I could tap into all the energies of the people who had traveled through there. And it was really a profound experience.
The book is called Heidi Across America, published by Health Communications, available at bookstores and online. Thank you so much, Heidi Byerly. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Grady. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. The show can also be found wherever you get podcasts, and we post all of our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Melody Edwards, today's audio producer, and Cody Hume, our social media manager, who's also this episode's digital producer. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.